This is Twit.
So if you've been following the news, you've certainly seen a whole lot about Facebook in the last couple of days, well, past week or so. Twitter, of course, made the move last week to begin adding labels to some of President Trump's most recent dangerous tweets. Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg has continued to hold steady that Facebook would not take similar action, would not follow in Twitter's footsteps in this regard. And they're catching a lot of heat for that, both from the public as well as internally. That might actually push some people away from the platform. But joining us to talk about why Facebook might actually be a better platform for educating more broadly than Twitter on racial injustice is Joshua Adams, who this morning published an article on this topic for Medium's 1-0. Welcome to the show, Joshua.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. It is really great to see you, and thank you for taking the time to talk with us about this. So first of all, there's so much information. It almost feels like information overload at this moment. You open up Twitter, it can be kind of overwhelming looking at the stream of information and learning what we are. But you write about context collapse as it relates to Twitter's character limits specifically, but I'm sure there is more to this. Talk a little bit about how that ultimately limits the message when it's delivered on a platform like Twitter.
Yeah, so I mean, even though I did mention the character limit, I did want to say that all mediums have this problem, all platforms have this problem. One of the analogies that I give when I'm teaching this kind of concept in class is think about language. So like on one hand, so like, we're speaking English. The amount of things that we can say at any given moment, even though it seems that it can be infinite, it actually is bounded by the amount of, words that we actually have at our disposal. And so like platforms, to use a different analogy, you can think of it as like a camera taking a picture. So, no matter how much you can kind of get with inside of a picture, there's still things that are outside of the frame. So, again, I'm just using these examples to illustrate the point that all platforms have these issues. What it pertains to Twitter in specific is that we have to try to get out our ideas in the most kind of like pithy and confined area, do it in the most, the shortest amount of time. But that actually creates a certain context collapse in terms of how people are perceiving our messages. And so let me kind of walk you through an example. So, obviously on Twitter, there's only, and again, any platform to be fair, but on Twitter, there's only a certain amount of context that you can actually give in any one tweet. And so, I say a statement that's political. Obviously, politics exists on a spectrum. But let's just say I say some political statement that is pro-Democrat, pro-Republican, whatever, it will fit on. So on one side, whatever I say, the people who agree with me, the people who are coming from that, the ideological, philosophical, et cetera, so forth, experiential perspective, they're going to take what I said as the most precise, representative kind of distillation of what they believe, right? They're like, oh, right, me, I believe that too, and they retweet, right? Mm-hmm. But let's think about how that is viewed on the other side. The same exact tweet saying the same exact thing when viewed from the other side is the least precise thing. It has the least amount of context. It's a caricature. And to a certain extent, it doesn't even have the improper amount of context. It has the wrong context. So it's the same exact thing, except, depending on where you're coming from, it's read in a totally fundamentally different way. In terms of, what Twitter's, the limits there, also I actually would say just, and I know this might seem a little bit arbitrary to folks, but I would actually say literally the actual visual space, is certain limited. So just before this interview, I just like, and obviously it's not scientific or precise, but I went on Facebook and I tried to like think about how much space does one post take versus on Twitter, how much space does one post take? So in the same amount of space that only one post took on Facebook, you could fit about 2 to 4 posts on Twitter. And so what that does is on Facebook, at least if you are looking at something, especially if something that has like a video or a photo, attached to it, it's going to stop the eye, or has the better potential to stop the eye than just a cascade of information. And so, again, those are just some of the limitations, the only limitations. But there's just like some of the ways that the way that we use Twitter and share, information on Twitter. Yes, it has a certain advantages. But in the article, I'm just making the case that if you actually want to like teach people about things, you want to do that kind of really hard work of persuasion, then Facebook may be the better platform. And there's like a bunch of different reasons for that.
Yeah. And I mean, when talking about the strengths of platforms, Twitter has been forced to evolve because its users created kind of this process of, hey, this is not enough characters to say, you know, dive deep into this topic. So they end up doing the threading. You know, it's a feature that essentially Twitter added after users were forcing the platform to allow for this. Meanwhile, Facebook totally allows for this. Is there, in your view, is there like the potential of kind of almost adding too much context for the efficacy of the platform? Facebook allows for a lot more, but does that run the risk of turning someone away from that information instead of pulling them into it? I hope that's clear, but I don't know.
No, what do you definitely think about that? Definitely. Yeah, definitely. There is, and again, this is, I think, some of the things that we're going to be talking about, and I feel like I'm, you know, going to be kind of like a broken record on this. All platforms have certain limitations. They all have certain benefits. They all have certain affordances, but they all have certain kind of confines. And so what I would say, you know, to that is, like, I think we should also think about context not just merely as information, but we can also think about it as space. And though, even though I am making a case in the article that you can give more information, I'm not saying that the information should necessarily be, just so much or limitless, right? Make a length long Facebook post. No one's going to read, Facebook post that's actually visually pages long. But I do think the type of kind of context as space, space as context, to revise, is important. And so, again, I just think it's helpful that and even analogies have their own flaws, but analogies help people understand things. So, you know, when you walk into the gym, you're going to be wearing different things than if you walk into class. When you get on social media kind of broadly, we use social media to communicate. We look to, access information, look at share articles, look at videos of cats. One of my favorite animals is otters, so I just love looking at pictures of otters. But one of the other things is identity formation. And so we get to use these digital spaces to curate our identity in a certain way that we can't in real life. And so while I'm not saying that there's some overlap between how people use Twitter and Facebook, I would argue that because people on Facebook tend to be more people in your personal life, more so than on Twitter. They're more so in kind of like your professional life. And again, I'm somewhat making a truism, a generalization, but I hope people, take me in good faith. And so in the context of, Twitter, if you are trying to explain a certain issue, especially if your Twitter profile is not set on private, this is also kind of where context collapse coming in, right? So I tweet out something, potentially, 300, million people can see what I tweeted, potentially. On Facebook, people tend to kind of set their private settings on, personal limit, to a certain extent. And so my circle is, even though it's somewhat counterintuitive, there's like 2 billion more people on Facebook, but the circles are more intimate. And so if I'm an activist and I'm trying to, explain to someone my experience with police. So like give them a negative interaction I have with police, or a positive, whatever it is. But if I'm trying to explain an experience that I have with police officers on Twitter, not only am I speaking to my intended audience, I'm also speaking to people who are coming from the exact ideological perspective as me. I'm talking to bots and I'm talking to fake profiles. I may be talking to, you know, white supremacists posing as black people. I might be talking to Russian bots, et cetera, so forth. Mm-hmm. If I'm on Facebook, and again, I'm somewhat overgeneralizing, but I just want to simplify it for other people to understand it. If I'm on Facebook, I'm talking to my friends, my family and their family, and to whatever, you know, exponent that you want to go out to, right? And so if somebody looks at my Facebook post, they have to see me. They have to see my face. They can't make me just a negative example of whatever they're trying to think of. They actually have to kind of approach me as a person. And again, it's not to the same extent that they would have to in real life. Like literally they see me, you know, face to face, none of this stuff, can substitute for face-to-face interaction. But I do think there's a certain context in which, you know, people go on Facebook to, you know, argue. They also go on Facebook to look at cats or memes. One of the very dominant, kind of uses of Twitter is, you know, irony and outrage. Irony on the left is what's going to get you kind of the most retweets. On the right, outrages, and to a certain extent, both of those would function in reverse as well. But I just think the actual spaces of Twitter and Facebook are different. And so that's also an extra context that we need to think about.
So last thing, you are working on a book right now about the black experience in tech, and you actually published an excerpt from the book on Medium about the intersection between memes and black English. So from your perspective, how is it that the meme culture that you wrote about is showing up in this moment? How is that meme culture playing a role right now?
I would say, you know, memes are, as it particularly pertains to, you know, all the things that are going on now, whether it's the, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic or the, the protests, against police brutality, the subsequent riots, and things like that. Memes are a really expressive way for people to, promote their own, like, political commentary. Mm-hmm. The power in memes actually comes from a combination of the visual and the juxtaposition between the visual and whatever like words you're attaching to it. So like just a visual in and of itself isn't a meme. You need, those words. The words kind of like recontextualize it. And so obviously if you're trying to say something funny, you use words that are ironic, maybe have like certain kind of like cultural or subcultural like allusions. So I'm wearing a Scott Pilgrim shirt. And if I said, you made me swallow my gum, if you watched the movie before, you would get that reference. If you saw that meme, if you didn't watch the movie before, then, obviously you wouldn't get the reference. One of the downsides of meme use, and I guess it's kind of on the same, it's kind of a heads and tails thing. One of the downsides of memes is that they are often, very, very, powerful forms of propaganda and disinformation. Mm-hmm. In this case, I actually do mean propaganda in a negative sense. I don't necessarily mean it in the, I usually try to use that word only in the academic sense. So propaganda just means kind of like trying to propagate a certain idea. But in a negative sense, what memes allow people to do is they allow people to repurpose visual texts for their own purposes. And so like if someone took a picture at the protests and, someone is destroying a police officer, one person could create destroying a police officer's car. Mm-hmm. I'll rephrase that.
Yeah.
right. Destroying a police officer's car. One person can take that picture and create a meme saying, the revolution has started, it gets likes, retweets, et cetera, so forth. another person takes that exact meme, you know, that exact picture, creates a meme and says, you know, look at these animals, but you want us to believe that your life matters, right? That's the same exact, you know, information, the same exact visual, but when you repurpose it, you could actually, you know, use that visual for, you know, your own, you know, political, ideological, et cetera, so forth purposes. So memes are very powerful, you know, as someone who uses the internet, as a journalist, academic, as just a everyday consumer. I love memes. Some of the, you know, memes can definitely brighten up your day. But in terms of the spheres in which misinformation and disinformation are being spread, memes, I would almost argue in my academic sense that memes are probably the most powerful form of disinformation and propaganda. So we need to understand it and be mindful of that.
It's fascinating. I would say that my group chat with my family, I can literally open it up on my computer right now and scroll through, and the vast majority of the conversations that we have there are in memes, and especially talking about the situation right now. I think one of the benefits of it is the way that it can sort of take a big idea and condense it down into something that is easily understood. And definitely. When it does that, I think that that's when it can be powerful, because I can remember, you know, you come across a few and you go, oh my God, that's the point I've been trying to make, but I've never made it so succinctly. And I find those to be very powerful. But I do wonder if it's less powerful in terms of communicating to another group and more powerful just in sort of preaching to the choir, so to speak, because at the same time, I can remember seeing when, you know, there's the conversation about, and it's not even a conversation, but when someone doesn't understand Black Lives Matter and they suggest that all lives matter, as if that's not the same thing. And
the burning
when that
house
conversation
meme.
Comes. Yes, exactly. And you have those memes, but then you, when there are folks that are trying to argue that, that all lives matter is a better representation. I know that even in myself, I see a meme, you know, being shared from that argument, from that standpoint. And I immediately go, okay, I'm not going to be able to understand this because it doesn't make sense. And so I wonder then if folks have the same idea on the other side, where they see me trying to explain to them what this means and why this is important to say. And then they look at it and they go, oh, you know, I'm not going to get it. I don't understand it. So it almost feels like maybe memes are good ways to sort of have conversations with people who are like-minded. But do you feel that they can be means, can memes be means of conveying a message to another group?
Oh, definitely. And I mean, there's, you know, as you said, like memes are powerful in a way that they kind of like condense these like really big and complex and nuanced ideas and distill them into this like bite-sized thing that people can easily digest. I do think that, like, for example, those like that one meme that like explains Black Lives Matter. And there's like a person talking about like all houses matter when, you know, their house is on fire. And so there's a way that you can explain this concept. I just would say that we just need to understand, and maybe this is like somewhat indirectly not, well, maybe it's not answering your question, but I do feel like we need to understand that like people are also using the same type of format that we, honestly and objectively are saying that it distills this idea in a very simple way. You, on the other hand, you could make someone believe something that is demonstratively false by making it simple. And so, for example, let's say we're talking about like crimes committed by illegal immigrants or undocumented workers. If you were somebody who was come from a political bent and, you know, you don't want more immigration, you could make a meme, right? You could scour, because the search, we can search this stuff. So you can scour the internet. You really only need to find one example of an undocumented immigrant doing a crime. You don't need to find a bunch. You just need to find one example. you can make up statistics and then just put those statistics on the picture and say, you know, undocumented immigrants are responsible for 50% of the crime, and then you put out that meme. The fact that it's true or not actually is not the point. When you see the statistic and then you see the person committing the crime, if you're already coming from that, you know, that experience, that ideological, that philosophical, that political, such and so forth background, you're not even going to check to see if the stats are correct, because the meme is already giving you what you wanted. You kind of, it's truthy. It's not truth, but it feels true. It doesn't matter if it is true. It just feels true. And so you share it. One of the examples that I give in my classes, and it's somewhat of like a trick that I pull on students. Someone made a meme in which they actually were trolling Blue Lives Matter, people who support Blue Lives Matter. And so in the meme, there was a picture, I believe the officer's name was Eric Dorner. But a few years back, he actually went on as an African-American officer, and he went on a shooting rampage and killed a few officers. And in the meme, it's like, you know, if you should support this fallen soldier and share this picture. Now, in context, it had like a Blue Lives Matter flag. It had an American flag. He was in like uniform and such and so forth. If you're coming from that background, you're not even going to be thinking about like, oh, wait, who is this person? Really, should I be serving? You know, should I be, retweeting this? Should I be sharing this? No, the thing that you're going to think is, well, I support the police. I support the military. I support the American flag. So, of course, I'm going to share this, not even knowing that you just shared a meme of a dude who went on a shooting rampage and killed a bunch of police officers. And so, you know, memes, because, again, it's the visual context and, you know, the textual, it is that juxtaposition and the meaning that is created between those two. Memes can be a thing that could help persuade people. And it's not going to persuade everybody, but it is a thing that can help persuade people. But it also could be, you know, a very effective way to propagandize, you know, people as well. And so, you know, I think that just as, you know, internet users, social media users, people use this stuff every day, we just always just be mindful and try to be aware of, you know, how some of the tools, some of the things that we're looking at every day could, you know, be, you know, effective. But again, effective could be, you know, kind of either way. Effective could be, you know, helping people to the best extent. Effective can also be, you know, burning their house down, because obviously fire would be the most effective thing to burn.